Hi, I'm Deputy Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
This is Michael Dackinson.
And he's starring in The King's Speech, which is coming to National Theater here in D.C. From February 11th through the 16th. So only a week. Make sure you get your tickets. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to join us, man.
You bet. You bet. Happy to be here.
Okay, awesome. So we all remember the movie. And God, hard to believe it was 10 years ago now. It won Best Picture, Best Actor,
yeah.
Colin Firth.
Yeah.
Before we get into your play, memories, you know, when you experienced that the first time, when it came out, or did you have to come back and check it out when you got the role in the show?
Well, believe it or not, I used to work for Miramax Films and as a script reader. I wrote coverage for them as sort of a side job as an actor. So I was doing a show out of town at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis when the original screenplay to that came across my desk or was emailed to me. So I first read it in like 2007 and really liked it then. And then, of course, when I saw the film, it was, you know, it was probably better than the screenplay that I'd read or how I'd imagined it. And no, I haven't gone back to look at it since then. I have a clear picture in my mind, but I also didn't want to, you know, specifically make or not make choices based on what, you know, what they'd chosen for the film. So I wanted to go from kind of our own research and then also what we came up with in rehearsal.
Wait, so you were the one who did the original coverage on it before they...
Yeah, I'm sure it made the rounds. Yeah, I'm sure it made the rounds. I was not the only person who read it, but I did read one of the, you know, one of the early drafts of the project, and I thought it was, you know, a wonderful idea. It definitely got a consider from me.
Do you remember what you wrote as like your little coverage notes?
You know, I don't remember it other than to think that like this was a great project. It was just a great idea. Like, it wasn't something that I was aware of,
right.
And it fits with what I'm interested in. You know, having gone to like acting school and taken voice class and, you know, dealt with all of those things, the idea that someone from that background actually helped the King of England, you know, overcome this impediment was really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great story. Let's remind. I mean, you started going into it a little bit, but let's take a step back and remind our listeners what the plot was. Maybe we have some younger folks.
Sure.
In speech when it came out. Just give them the basic, you know, boilerplate.
Sure.
Here.
So essentially, what you have in this play, and it's a bit adapted from the real history. They actually worked together a bit longer, like almost 10 years longer than what you see in the film and in the play. He was trying to conquer this issue and got help from Logue earlier than what you see in the movie. But essentially, you have somebody that's the second in line to be king and has always hoped that he won't have to be king because he has such a debilitating stammer when he's in public. And, of course, these public figures are called upon to give speeches at big events, and he'd had this speech to give at Wembley Stadium in the 20s that – he was so halting. It was just, I think, for him, a terrible embarrassment, and it was difficult. So it was difficult for him to imagine taking on the kingly duties. Well, he didn't think he would have to deal with it, except that his brother, David, who became King Edward, had an affair with an American heiress and divorcee named Wallis Simpson, and quite shockingly, on the eve of World War II, abdicated the throne, putting Albert, Bertie, as he was called among his family, in line to be the next king at a time of total crisis in Europe and in England. So he was going to need to find his voice right away. And there you have the king's speech, the preparations for that, and him overcoming those obstacles.
Now, it's so – thanks for summing that up for us, or
sure.
Reminding everybody. But it has all the makings of so many through lines of, you know, what so many great stories are. You have,
sure.
You know, that you have that underdog story of him with his, you know, speech impediment, overcoming that. But then you also have, you know, the buddy team or the, you know,
yes.
The bromance, the relationship that you form
yeah.
by, you know, interacting. Talk about how sort of that... you know, it's not a buddy comedy, but you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, talk about how that bond sort of grows throughout the show.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Logue really recognizes that this was so debilitating to him that it kept Birdie from developing deep friendships with other classmates, friends growing up. He had a very close relationship with his wife, and that's who he could trust. But he didn't have friends, and so he formed a deep bond pretty early on with his therapist, with Logue. And that's a real, true, genuine friendship in real life and in the story that went on from when they first started working together in the 20s to his death in 1951, 52.
Awesome. There's not many speech therapist roles. I mean, I guess you got your Henry Higgins and stuff, but that's a completely different thing. But
yeah.
How did you do, what did you tap into for that? What research did you have to, to become a speech pathologist?
Well, I did research just to the extent of, reading source material about this and dramaturgy, which is basically stage historians put together packets of information about the time period. But by happenstance, in my own training, I trained at both Yale and the University of California, San Diego in voice for the stage. And that is, in a way, like three or four generations after this guy, Logue, who in a way kind of invented it. He'd done elocution, but this idea of working with people who are traumatized or working with people that have significant issues in speaking, that ended up becoming part of actor training. But for Logue, it came very specifically out of helping Australia. He was Australian, helping Australians who were returning from World War I. And these guys had been, in the trenches. You hear about shell shock. They, for months on end, if not longer, they were just enduring the unendurable. And many came back unable to speak. And so he would, as a young Australian elocution specialist who had basically been reciting Shakespeare and encouraging people to do public speaking, he was the sought-out person to try and deal with these issues. And he got into not just having them do tongue twisters and muscle work, but doing more of therapy, where they're really engaging with their anger, engaging with what's keeping them from speaking, and letting that out. So it's sort of a process of therapy in general.
Absolutely. And now you mentioned the big the Wembley speech in the 20s that you said that King George was terrified to do because he still had the stutter to overcome.
Yeah.
How on the book end of that, on the backside, his big triumphant moment is when he steps up to do his big first wartime broadcast when Britain declares war on Germany in 1939, 2 years before the U.S. got involved even.
Yeah.
Talk about how that is such a rousing, goosebump-inducing thing where we've watched two acts of this play or 2 hours of the movie, and we watch him get up and come through and inspire his nation in the darkest part of the 20th century.
Yeah, and I think that's really appropriate that somebody who had to struggle themselves so much to be heard does have the breakthrough. And it's not him standing up there like Braveheart. It's coming out of what he can do, which is from a real emotional, a place of emotional reserve, and putting that out there, that and projecting the confidence that he's developed by working on this for so long. So I think it's cool, like you mentioned earlier, the underdog, the idea that somebody who was terrified to speak and was unable to do it is able to triumph. I think it gives Britons facing down the Nazi juggernaut confidence that they can. But they can stand up to that.
Absolutely. Now, who plays your King George, on stage with you? And, just dote on him a little bit, what makes him great to work with. And also, a little bit of how he actually physically does the stammer, because that's a thing, you want it to be, put on, and then it would be, offensive or something, how make it realistic. But, just kind of dote on your co-star a little bit here.
Sure, yeah. A guy named Nick Westraith, who's a fantastic actor. Lots of stage work, lots of TV and film experience. Juilliard-trained actor. And I'm just getting to know him now. We've been rehearsing for a couple of weeks, and he's really, really terrific at this. He's taking it in terms of in terms of dealing with the stammer and the stutter. He's done quite a bit of research into it and watched documentaries about it, but it's just getting very specific for him in, like, what words trip him up or what emotional things trip him up, so that it's not, you know, a wash of stammering constantly. It's very specific things that create issues for him. So then the therapy is, on my end, is seeing where can I get him to not stammer? Where is he able to flow with his speech? And it happens when he gets angry, and it happens when he sings, it happens when he moves. So if I can get him to do things, you know, when he's working on other activities, so I get him to build models with me. I get him to sing through, sing what he wants to say. I get him to swear and get angry and get that, you know, the juices flowing that way, so that he's not pulling back into himself. And he's just a brilliant actor. So he's been trying different stuff, but it's very convincing and makes you feel for him and then also be happy for him as he succeeds.
Awesome. Now, earlier you mentioned that, you know, in addition to your, you know, speech therapist, that his wife was the one that, you know, he leaned on and trusted mm-hmm. and could count on. Who played, you know, go into her role a little bit in the show, you know, who plays her and, you know, how big of a part is it in on stage? Is it as much as the movie?
It's played by Maggie Lacey. Maggie's a terrific actress who I've known for quite some time. It's the first time that we're getting to work together, but I've seen her work before and knew her. I've known her for, I don't know, 18 years or something. She's really great. She's, again, just right now we're just rehearsing with the four of us. And we're bringing the rest of the cast in very soon, sort of one by one. So it's been my wife, who's played by Elizabeth Lado, Nick Westrade, and Maggie. So, yeah, they have quite a few scenes together, and she's definitely deeply in love with him. And interestingly, the character says, you know, I fell in love with you because of the stammer. I didn't want to be in this gilded cage. I wanted to have more of a life than having to be the queen. Of course, it turns out that she's going to end up being the queen anyway. I think she liked him because he was vulnerable and he was compassionate and he wasn't the dashing matinee idol that that his brother was.
Gotcha. Now, what do we see visually? I mean, I know we're a radio station, so try to paint a visual picture for me. But, you know, it's you got this, you know, the great, you know, 30s, you know, on the brink of World War II period costumes mm-hmm. and set.
Sure.
And, you know, just describe, you know, what the visual feast we have here.
Yeah, so they're actually building suits here at this wonderful place in Midtown for us, so that there's going to be period suits that make sense for it. There's also the, you know, the costume that the king wears for the coronation. The women as well will have beautiful dresses and really great lighting design. And the way that the play has been structured, in order to accommodate all of the storytelling, the scenes are quite short. So rather than having, you know, curtain up, curtain down 50 times, you're having these kind of seamless transitions where you move from one scene to the next. The scene might only be 2 minutes long, and then another scene's 5 minutes, and then 2 minutes, and then seven. And they'll be using projections of, you know, digital projections of the setting, so you get a sense of where they are. It's something that plays are doing a lot more lately, and it allows for compressed storytelling. So you'll see the interior of Westminster Abbey when they're preparing for the big speech. You'll see, you know, parts of England, parts of London that frame the parts of the story that you're in.
Awesome. And who's directing you guys in this piece?
This is a director named Michael Wilson, who I've worked with a number of times. Really, really great director. He brought The Trip to Bountiful to Broadway and The Best Man and Not About Nightingale. Several other things have gone to Broadway. I developed a play, another historical piece I developed with him a few years ago that was about the development of anesthesia in the 19th century and the fight over who owned that. And that was an interesting play, quite good in its own way. Similarly, a big scope with lots of scenes telling this big story. I think this one, however, the playwright has really gotten down to, you know, the essential necessary language, the essential themes, and tells the story really effectively and efficiently.
Nice. Now, I always, whenever we have sort of a historical based story or biopic sort of thing, I always mm-hmm. like to ask, you know, makes it, what sort of things are relevant to today in this thing? I mean, you know, there's seems sometimes, depending on the news of the day, on the brink of another world war sometimes, but
right.
what do you think makes it relevant, you know, to back, you know, on the cusp of World War II back then?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think rather than just being sort of any one-to-one specific relevancy, I just think that story is sort of, you know, the hero's journey, that there's someone, that there are people that are called upon at certain times to go above and beyond what they're comfortable with or what they think they're even capable of. So I'm trying to think of like a current example of that, but I think that that's sort of timeless, that people are super afraid of taking on the responsibility, super afraid of having to be the person that steps up. But sometimes that's exactly who you want in a time like that. So I don't know, you could, maybe somebody else can find out what that applies to right now. But I think that story of overcoming personal obstacles more than anything else, it's not the other people that are holding him back. It's not Hitler so much. It's his own trauma and the trauma of his childhood, that he was teased. Everything that they did to try to get him to stop stammering had the opposite effect. It was a time when he had issues with his legs. He was called bandy legs or something. And so instead of some sort of therapy that would encourage him to move better, he was put in metal splints that caused him so much pain that he'd cry out in the night. He was abused by a very deranged nurse that was supposed to raise him. Of course, at that time, parents were a little bit more hands-off, so you might put him in the charge of a governess, and they weren't always the best people. So I think that more so than any particular political current situation, I think just the timelessness of overcoming personal obstacles to become the best you and then saving the world in the process is something that's always going to appeal.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. It's that personal journey of the underdog story and his own, you know, challenges he overcomes. That's going to be the universal thing we all latch on to. And
yeah.
I love how you said that saving the world in the process is kind of bonus icing on the cake, the larger
right.
context. But it's that personal journey, absolutely. And just sort of to close this out here, you know, speaking of that personal journey, what do you want audience members to, you know, what do you want their takeaway to be? You know, they come see it because you love the movie or they always heard about the King's Speech. But then, you know, as they experience this and it washes over them in National Theater, what sort of, you know, inspiration or takeaways, you know, what do you want them feeling when they head out?
Well, I think either for themselves or somebody that they're close with, if they see someone that's struggling with deep personal issues or things that are holding them back, I think to hold in their mind that it can be overcome, that by confronting it, by acknowledging it, by talking about it, by addressing it, you know, it's speech therapy, but it's in a way it's therapy. It could be like physical therapy or it could be talk therapy, that you can, if you have the courage to acknowledge what you need to work on, and then you have the strength and the perseverance to keep pushing, even though it's painful, even though it makes you feel insecure, even though you feel like you can't do it, if you keep going, you can succeed. So I hope that people are inspired by that and have compassion for people that are close to them, far away from them, or themselves.
Well said. Thanks for taking time to join us. Remind us before we go, where are we in the tour? It sounds like you're in the early stages of, you know, just the four of you rehearsing now, but
yeah.
where does National Theater fall on the, is it towards the beginning of the tour? Or where
it
where
is. It is. And there's going to be all kinds of people, you know, personnel is going to be changing. The script may be changing, but this is its own. I like to think of this is its own version. The national one is not what happened in Chicago or necessarily what's going to happen in Hartford. You guys are going to get your own treat of what this is. I imagine that they're hoping that it will move to New York, maybe to Broadway. It's been in Chicago. It's going to be here. It will have a life in Hartford, potentially Toronto, potentially Phoenix. I don't know if there's other stuff. That's kind of up in the air. It's not nailed down yet, but that's where that's at.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to seeing it. Everybody, it's the King's Speech at National Theater here in D.C. From Tuesday, February 11th through Sunday, February 16th. So it's your tickets now. Hey, thanks so much for calling. This is great.
You bet, Jason.